This is Audible.
Books on Tape presents Moneyball, The Art of Winning an Unfair Game, written by Michael Lewis, read by Scott Brick. Lately, in a wreck of a California ship, one of the passengers fastened a belt about him with 200 pounds of gold in it, with which he was found afterwards at the bottom. Now, as he was sinking, had he the gold, or the gold him? John Ruskin, Unto This Last. Preface. I wrote this book because I fell in love with the story. The story concerned a small group of undervalued professional baseball players and executives, many of whom had been rejected as unfit for the big leagues, who had turned themselves into one of the most successful franchises in Major League Baseball. But the idea for the book came well before I had good reason to write it, before I had a story to fall in love with. It began really with an innocent question. How did one of the poorest teams in baseball, the Oakland Athletics, win so many games? For more than a decade, the people who run professional baseball have argued that the game was ceasing to be an athletic competition and becoming a financial one. The gap between rich and poor in baseball was far greater than in any other professional sport, and widening rapidly. At the opening of the 2002 season, the richest team, the New York Yankees, had a payroll of $140 million, while the two poorest teams, the Oakland A's and the Tampa Bay Devil Rays, had payrolls of less than a third of that, about $40 million. A decade before, the highest payroll team, the New York Mets, had spent about $44 million on baseball players, and the lowest payroll team, the Cleveland Indians, a bit more than $8 million. The growing disparities meant that only the rich teams could afford the best players. A poor team could afford only the maimed and the inept and was almost certain to fail. Or so argued the people who ran baseball. And I was inclined to concede the point. The people with the most money often win. But when you actually looked at what had happened over the past few years, you had to wonder. The bottom of each division was littered with teams, the Rangers, the Orioles, the Dodgers, the Mets, that had spent huge sums and failed spectacularly. On the other end of the spectrum was Oakland. For the past several years, working with either the lowest or next-to-lowest payroll in the game, the Oakland A's had won more regular season games than any other team, except the Atlanta Braves. They'd been to the playoffs 3 years in a row, and in the previous two, taken the richest team in baseball, the Yankees, to within a few outs of elimination. How on earth had they done that? The Yankees, after all, were the most egregious example of financial determinism. The Yankees understood what New York understood, that there was no shame in buying success. And maybe because of their lack of shame, they did what they did better than anyone in the business. As early as 1999, Major League Baseball Commissioner Bud Selig had taken to calling the Oakland A's success an aberration. But that was less an explanation than an excuse not to grapple with the question, how'd they do it? What was their secret? How did the second poorest team in baseball, opposing ever greater mountains of cash, stand even the faintest chance of success, much less the ability to win more regular season games than all but one of the other 29 teams? For that matter, what was it about baseball success that resisted so many rich men's attempt to buy it? These were the questions that first interested me, and this book seeks to answer. That answer begins with an obvious point. In professional baseball, it still matters less how much money you have than how well you spend it. When I first stumbled into the Oakland front office, they were coming off a season in which they had spent $34 million and won an astonishing 102 games. The year before that, 2000, they'd spent $26 million and won 91 games and their division. A leading independent authority on baseball finance, a Manhattan lawyer named Doug Pappas, pointed out a quantifiable distinction between Oakland and the rest of baseball. The least you could spend on a 25-man team was $5 million, plus another $2 million more for players on the disabled list and the remainder of the 40-man roster. The huge role of luck in any baseball game, and the relatively small difference in ability between most major leaguers and the rookies who might work for the minimum wage, meant that the fewest games a minimum wage baseball team would win during a 162-game season is something like 49. The Pappas measure of financial efficiency was, how many dollars over the minimum $7 million does each team pay for each win over its 49th? How many marginal dollars does a team spend for each marginal win? Over the past 3 years, the Oakland A's had paid about $500,000 per win. The only other team in six figures was the Minnesota Twins at $675,000 per win. The most profligate rich franchises, the Baltimore Orioles, for instance, or the Texas Rangers, paid nearly $3 million for each win, or more than six times what Oakland paid. Oakland seemed to be playing a different game than everyone else. In any ordinary industry, the Oakland A's would have long since acquired most other baseball teams and built an empire. But this was baseball, so they could only embarrass other, richer teams on the field and leave it at that. At the bottom of the Oakland experiment was a willingness to rethink baseball. How it is managed, how it is played, who is best suited to play it, and why. Understanding that he would never have a Yankee-sized checkbook, the Oakland A's general manager, Billy Beane, had set about looking for inefficiencies in the game. Looking for, in essence, new baseball knowledge. In what amounted to a systematic scientific investigation of their sport, the Oakland front office had re-examined everything from the market price of foot speed to the inherent difference between the average major league player and the superior AAA one. That's how they found their bargains. Many of the players drafted or acquired by the Oakland A's had become the victims of an unthinking prejudice rooted in baseball's traditions. The research and development department in the Oakland front office liberated them from this prejudice and allowed them to demonstrate their true worth. A baseball team, of all things, was at the center of a story about the possibilities and the limits of reason in human affairs. Baseball, of all things, was an example of how an unscientific culture responds or fails to respond to the scientific method. As I say, I fell in love with the story. The story is about professional baseball and the people who play it. At its center is a man whose life was turned upside down by professional baseball and who miraculously found a way to return the favor. In an effort to learn more about him and the revolution he was inspiring, I spent a few days with J.P. Ricciardi, the general manager of the Toronto Blue Jays. Ricciardi had worked with Billy Beane in Oakland and was now having a ball tearing down and rebuilding his new team along the same radical lines as the Oakland A's. Ridiculed at first, Ricciardi had, by the time I met him, earned the respect of even the crustiest of the old baseball writers. By the end of the 2002 season, the big fear in Toronto was that he would bolt town for the job that had been offered to him to run the Boston Red Sox, who now said that they, too, wished to reinvent their organization in the image of the Oakland A's. It was at a Red Sox game that I tried to tempt Ricciardi into a self-serving conversation. Months before, he had said to me, and with some insistence, that there was a truly astonishing discrepancy between Billy Beane and every other general manager in the game. He'd raised one hand as high as he could and lowered the other as low as he could and said, "Billy is up here, and everyone else is down here." Now, as we sat watching the Boston Red Sox lose to his brand new Blue Jays, I asked Ricciardi if he was willing to entertain the possibility that he was as good at this strange business of running a baseball team as the man he'd left behind in Oakland. He just laughed at me. There was no question that Billy was the best in the game. The question was, why? Chapter 1. The Curse of Talent. Those whom the gods wish to destroy, they first call promising. Cyril Connolly, Enemies of Promise. The first thing they always did was run you. When big league scouts road-tested a group of elite amateur prospects, foot speed was the first item they checked off their lists. The scouts actually carried around checklists. tools is what they called the talents they were checking for in a kid. There were 5 tools, the abilities to run, throw, field, hit, and hit with power. A guy who could run had wheels. A guy with a strong arm had a hose. Scouts spoke the language of auto mechanics. You could be forgiven if you listened to them for thinking they were discussing sports cars and not young men. On this late spring day in San Diego, several big league teams were putting a group of prospects through their paces. If the feeling in the air was a bit more tense than it used to be, that was because it was 1980. The risks in drafting baseball players had just risen. A few years earlier, professional baseball players had been granted free agency by a court of law, and after about 2 seconds of foot shuffling, baseball owners put prices on players that defied the old commonsensical notions of what a baseball player should be paid. Inside of 4 years, the average big league salary had nearly tripled from about $52,000 to almost $150,000 a year. The new owner of the New York Yankees, George Steinbrenner, had paid $10 million for the entire team in 1973. In 1975, he paid $3.75 million for baseball's first modern free agent, Catfish Hunter. A few years ago, no one thought twice about bad calls on prospects. But what used to be a $1,000 mistake was rapidly becoming a $1 million one. Anyway, the first thing they always did was run you. 5 young men stretch and canter on the outfield crabgrass. Darnell Coles, Cecil Espy, Eric Erickson, Gary Harris, Billy Bean. They're still boys, really. All of them have had to produce letters from their mothers saying that it is okay for them to be here. No one outside their hometowns would ever have heard of them, but to the scouts, they already feel like household names. All 5 are legitimate first-round picks, among the 30 or so most promising prospects in the country. They've been culled from the nation's richest trove of baseball talent, Southern California, and invited to the baseball field at San Diego's Herbert Hoover High to answer a question. Who is the best of the best? As the boys get loose, a few scouts chit-chat on the infield grass. In the outfield, Pat Gillick, the general manager of the Toronto Blue Jays, stands with a stopwatch in the palm of his hand. Clustered around Gillick are 5 or 6 more scouts, each with his own stopwatch. One of them paces off 60 yards and marks the finish line with his foot. The boys line up along the left field foul line. To their left is the outfield wall, off which Ted Williams, as a high school player, smacked opposite field doubles. Herbert Hoover High is Ted Williams' alma mater. The fact means nothing to the boys. They are indifferent to their surroundings. Numb. During the past few months, they have been so thoroughly examined by so many older men that they don't even think about where they are performing or for whom. They feel more like sports cars being taken out for a spin than they do like young men being tested. Paul Weaver, the Padres scout, is here. He's struck by the kids' cool. Weaver has seen new kids panic when they work out for scouts. Mark McLemore, the same Mark McLemore who will one day be a $3 million a year outfielder for the Seattle Mariners, will vomit on the field before one of Weaver's workouts. These kids aren't like that. They have all been too good for too long. Darnell Coles, Cecil Espy, Eric Erickson, Gary Harris, Billy Bean. One of the scouts turns to another and says, "I'll take the 3 black kids, Coles, Harris, Espy. They'll dust the white kids, and Espy will dust everyone, even Coles." Coles is a sprinter who has already signed a football scholarship to play wide receiver at UCLA. That's how fast Espy is. The scouts are certain that even Coles can't keep up with him. Gillick drops his hand. 5 born athletes lift up and push off. They're at full tilt after just a few steps. It's all over inside of 7 seconds. Billy Bean has made all the others look slow. Espy finishes 2nd, 3 full strides behind him. And as straightforward as it seems, what ambiguity could there possibly be in a 60-yard dash? Gillick is troubled. He hollers at one of the scouts to walk off the track again and makes certain that the distance is exactly 60 yards. Then he tells the 5 boys to return to the starting line. The boys don't understand. They run you first, but they usually only run you once. They think maybe Gillick wants to test their endurance, but that's not what's on Gillick's mind. Gillick's job is to believe what he sees and disbelieve what he doesn't, and yet he cannot bring himself to believe what he's just seen. Just for starters, he doesn't believe that Billy Bean outran Cecil Espy and Darnell Coles fair and square. Nor does he believe the time on his stopwatch. It reads 6.4 seconds. You'd expect that from a sprinter, not a big kid like this one. Not quite understanding why they are being asked to do it, the boys walk back to the starting line and run their race all over again. Nothing important changes. "Billy just flat out smoked them all," says Paul Weaver. When he was a young man, Billy Bean could beat anyone at anything. He was so naturally superior to whomever he happened to be playing against in whatever sport they happened to be playing that he appeared to be in a different, easier game. By the time he was a sophomore in high school, Billy was the quarterback on the football team and the high scorer on the basketball team. He found talents in himself almost before his body was ready to exploit them. He could dunk a basketball before his hands were big enough to palm it. Billy's father, no athlete himself, had taught his son baseball from manuals. A career naval officer, he'd spent 9 months on end at sea. When he was home in the family's naval housing, he was intent on teaching his son something. He taught him how to pitch. Pitching was something you could study and learn. Whatever the season, he'd take his son and his dog-eared baseball books to empty Little League diamonds. These sessions weren't simple fun. Billy's father was a perfectionist. He ran their pitching drills with military efficiency and boot camp intensity. Billy still felt lucky. He knew that he wanted to play catch every day, and that every day his father would play catch with him. By the time Billy was 14, he was 6 inches taller than his father and doing things that his father's books failed to describe. As a freshman in high school, he was brought up by his coach, over the angry objections of the older players, to pitch the last varsity game of the season. He threw a shutout with 10 strikeouts and went 2 for 4 at the plate. As a 15-year-old sophomore, he hit over 500 in one of the toughest high school baseball leagues in the country. By his junior year, he was 6'4", 180 pounds, and still growing, and his high school diamond was infested with major league scouts who watched him hit over 500 again. In the first big game after Billy had come to the scouts' attention, Billy pitched a two-hitter, stole 4 bases, and hit 3 triples. 22 years later, the triples would remain a California schoolboy record, but it was the way he'd hit them that stuck in the mind. The ballpark that day had no fences. It was just an endless hot tundra in the San Diego suburbs. After Billy hit the first triple over the heads of the opposing outfielders, the outfielders played him deeper. When he hit it over their heads the second time, the outfielders moved back again and played him roughly where the parking lot would have been outside a big league stadium. Whereupon, Billy hit it over their heads a third time. The crowd had actually laughed the last time he'd done it. That's how it was with Billy when he played anything, but especially when he played baseball. Blink, and you might miss something you'd never see again. He encouraged strong feelings in the older men who were paid to imagine what kind of pro ball player a young man might become. The boy had a body you could dream on. Ramrod straight and lean, but not so lean you couldn't imagine him filling out. And that face. Beneath an unruly mop of dark brown hair, the boy had the sharp features the scouts loved. Some of the scouts still believed they could tell by the structure of a young man's face not only his character, but his future in pro ball. They had a phrase they used, the good face. Billy had the good face. Billy's coach, Sam Blaylock, didn't know what to make of the scouts. "I've got this first-round draft pick," he says, "and 15 and 20 scouts showing up every time we scrimmage. And I didn't know what to do. I'd never played pro ball." 20 years later, Sam Blaylock would be selected by his peers as the best high school baseball coach in the country. His teams at Rancho Bernardo High School in San Diego would produce so many big league prospects that the school would come to be known in baseball circles as the Factory. But in 1979, Blaylock was only a few years into his job, and he was still in awe of Major League Baseball and its many representatives who turned up at his practices. Each and every one of them, it seemed, wanted to get to know Billy Bean personally. It got so that Billy would run from practice straight to some friend's house to avoid their incessant phone calls to his home. With the scouts, Billy was cool. With his coaches, Billy was cool. The only one who ever got to Billy where he lived was an English teacher who yanked him out of class one day and told him he was too bright to get by on his athletic gifts and his charm. For her, Billy wanted to be better than he was. For the scouts, well, the scouts, he could take or leave. What Sam Blaylock now thinks he should have done is to herd the scouts into a corner and tell them to just sit there until such time as they were called upon. What he did instead was whatever they wanted him to do. And what they wanted him to do was trot his star out for inspection. They'd ask to see Billy run. Sam would have Billy run sprints for them. They'd ask to see Billy throw, and Billy would proceed to the outfield and fire rockets to Sam at the plate. They'd want to see Billy hit, and Sam would throw batting practice with no one there but Billy and the scouts. Me throwing, Billy hitting, and 20 big league scouts in the outfield shagging flies, recalls Blaylock. Each time the scouts saw Billy, they saw only what they wanted to see, a future big league star. As for Billy, Sam just let him be. Baseball, to Blaylock's way of thinking, at least at the beginning of his career, was more of an individual than a team sport, and more of an instinctive athletic event than a learned skill. Handed an athlete of Billy's gift, Blaylock assumed, a coach should just let him loose. I was young and a little bit scared, Blaylock says, and I didn't want to screw him up. He'd later change his mind about what baseball was, but he'd never change his mind about Billy's talent. 22 years later, after more than 60 of his players and two of his nephews had been drafted to play pro baseball, Blaylock would say that he had yet to see another athlete of Billy's caliber. They all missed the clues. They didn't notice, for instance, that Billy's batting average collapsed from over 500 in his junior year to just over 300 in his senior year. It was hard to say why. Maybe it was the pressure of the scouts. Maybe it was that the other teams found different ways to pitch to him and Billy failed to adapt. Or maybe it was plain bad luck. The point is, no one even noticed the drop-off. I never looked at a single statistic of Billy's, admits one of the scouts. It wouldn't have crossed my mind. Billy was a five-tool guy. He had it all. Roger Young Award, the Mets' head scout, says, "You have to understand, we don't just look at performance. We were looking at talent." But in Billy's case, talent was a mask. Things went so well for him so often that no one ever needed to worry about how he behaved when they didn't go well. Blaylock worried, though. Blaylock lived with it. The moment Billy failed, he went looking for something to break. One time after Billy struck out, he whacked his aluminum bat against a wall with such violence that he bent it at a right angle. The next time he came to the plate, he was still so furious with himself that he insisted on hitting with the crooked bat. Another time he threw such a tantrum that Blaylock tossed him off the team. You have some guys that when they strike out and come back to the bench, all the other guys move down to the other end of the bench, says Blaylock. That was Billy. When things did not go well for Billy on the playing field, a wall came down between him and his talent, and he didn't know any other way to get through the wall than to try to smash a hole in it. It wasn't merely that he didn't like to fail. It was as if he didn't know how to fail. The scouts never considered this. By the end of Billy's senior year, the only question they had about Billy was, can I get him? And as the 1980 Major League draft approached, they were given reason to think not. The first bad sign was that the head scout from the New York Mets, Roger Young Award, took a more than usual interest in Billy. The Mets held the first overall pick in the 1980 draft, and so Billy was theirs for the taking. Word was that the Mets had winnowed their short list to two players, Billy and a Los Angeles high school player named Darryl Strawberry. Word also was that Young Award preferred Billy to Strawberry. He wasn't alone. There are good guys and there are premium guys, says Young Award. And Billy was a premium guy. He had the size, the speed, the arm, the whole package. He could play other sports. He was a true athlete. And then on top of all that, he had good grades in school, and he was going with all the prettiest girls. He had charm. He could have been anything. The other bad sign was that Billy kept saying he didn't want to play pro baseball. He wanted to go to college. Specifically, he wanted to attend Stanford University on a joint baseball and football scholarship. He was at least as interested in the school as the sports. The baseball recruiter from the University of Southern California had tried to talk Billy out of Stanford. "They'll make you take a whole week off for final exams," he'd said, to which Billy had replied, "That's the idea, isn't it?" A few of the scouts had tried to point out that Billy didn't actually play football. He'd quit after his sophomore year in high school to avoid an injury that might end his baseball career. Stanford didn't care. The university was in the market for a quarterback to succeed its current star, a sophomore named John Elway. The baseball team didn't have the pull that the football team had with the Stanford admissions office, and so the baseball coach asked the football coach to have a look at Billy. A few hours on the practice field, and the football coach endorsed Billy Bean as the man to take over after John Elway left. All Billy had to do was get his B in math. The Stanford athletic department would take care of the rest. And it had. By the day of the draft, every big league scout had pretty much written off Billy as unobtainable. "Billy just scared a lot of people away," recalls scout Paul Weaver. "No one thought he was going to sign." It was insane for a team to waste its only first-round draft choice on a kid who didn't want to play. The only one who refused to be scared off was Roger Youngeward. The Mets had 3 first-round picks in the 1980 draft, and so, Youngeward figured, the front office might be willing to risk one of them on a player who didn't sign. Plus, there was this other thing. In the months leading up to the draft, the Mets' front office had allowed themselves to become part of a strange experiment. Sports Illustrated had asked the Mets' general manager, Frank Cashin, if one of the magazine's reporters could follow the team as it decided who would become the first overall draft pick in the country. The Mets had shown the magazine its short list of prospects, and the magazine had said it would be convenient, journalistically, if the team selected Darryl Strawberry. Strawberry was just a great story. A poor kid from the inner city of Los Angeles who didn't know he was about to become rich and famous. Youngeward, who preferred Billy to Strawberry, argued against letting the magazine become involved at all because, as he put it later, "we'd be creating a monster. It had cost us a lot of money." The club overruled him. The Mets front office felt that the benefits of the national publicity outweighed the costs of raising Darryl Strawberry's expectations, or even of picking the wrong guy. The Mets took Strawberry with the first pick and paid him a then-fantastic signing bonus of $210,000. The Blue Jays took Gary Harris with the second pick of the draft. Darnell Coles went to the Mariners with the 6th pick, and Cecil Espy to the White Sox with the 8th pick. With their second first-round draft pick, the 23rd overall, the Mets let Roger Youngeward do what he wanted, and Youngeward selected Billy Bean. Youngeward had seen kids say they were going to college only to change their minds the minute the money hit the table. But in the weeks following the draft, he had laid $100,000 in front of Billy's parents, and it had done nothing to improve the tone of the discussion. He began to worry that Billy was serious. To the chagrin of Billy's mother, who was intent on her son going to Stanford, Youngeward planted himself in the Bean household. That didn't work either. "I wasn't getting the vibes I would like," Youngeward now says. "And so I took Billy to see the big club. It was 1980. The Bean family was military middle class. Billy had hardly been outside of San Diego, much less to New York City. To him, the New York Mets were not so much a baseball team as a remote idea. But that summer, when the Mets came to San Diego to play the Padres, Youngeward escorted Billy into the visitor's clubhouse. There Billy found waiting for him a Mets uniform with his name on the back and a receiving party of players. Lee Mazzilli, Mookie Wilson, Wally Backman. The players knew who he was. They came up to him and joked about how they needed him to hurry up and get his ass to the big leagues. Even the Mets manager, Joe Torre, took an interest. I think that's what turned Billy, says Young Award. He met the big league team and he thought, I can play with these guys. It was such a sacred place, says Billy, and it was closed off to so many people. And I was inside. It became real. The decision was Billy's to make. A year or so earlier, Billy's father had sat him down at a table and challenged him to arm wrestle. The gesture struck Billy as strange, unlike his father. His father was intense, but never physically aggressive. Father and son wrestled. Billy won. Afterwards, his father told Billy that if he was man enough to beat his father in arm wrestling, he was man enough to make his own decisions in life. The offer from the Mets was Billy's first big life decision. Billy told Roger Young Award he'd sign. What happened next was odd. Years later, Billy couldn't be sure if he'd dreamed it or it actually happened. After he told the Mets he planned to sign their contract, but before he'd actually done it, he changed his mind. When he told his father that he was having second thoughts, that he wasn't sure he wanted to play pro ball, his father said, "You made your decision. You're signing." In any case, Billy took the $125,000 offered by the Mets. He appeased his mother and his conscience by telling her and himself he would attend classes at Stanford during the off-season. Stanford disagreed. When the admissions office learned that Billy wouldn't be playing sports for Stanford, they told him that he was no longer welcome in Stanford's classrooms. "Dear Mrs. Bean," read the letter from the Stanford Dean of Admissions, Fred A. Hargadon, "we are withdrawing Billy's admission. I do wish him every success, both with his professional career in baseball and with his alternate plans for continuing his education." Just like that, a life changed. One day, Billy Bean could have been anything. The next, he was just another minor league baseball player, and not even a rich one. On the advice of a family friend, Billy's parents invested on their son's behalf his entire $125,000 bonus in a real estate partnership that promptly went bust. It was many years before Billy's mother would speak to Roger Young Award. Chapter 2. How to Find a Ballplayer. Years later, he would say that when he'd decided to become a professional baseball player, it was the only time he'd done something just for the money, and that he'd never do something just for the money ever again. He would never again let the market dictate the direction of his life. The funny thing about that, now he was running a poor Major League Baseball team, was that his job was almost entirely about money. Where to find it, how to spend it, whom to spend it on. There was no more intensely financial period in his life than the few weeks just after the regular season opened leading up to the amateur draft. There was also no time that he found more enjoyable. He didn't mind living with money at the center of his life so long as he was using it on other people and not having it used on him. He began that day in the summer of 2002 facing a room full of his scouts. Billy Bean, now in his 40th year on Earth and his 5th as the Oakland A's general manager, had changed. He'd lost the ramrod posture of his youth. The brown mop of hair had thinned and been trained poorly to part. Otherwise, the saggings and crinklings of middle age were barely discernible on him. The difference in Billy wasn't what had happened to him, but what hadn't. He had a life he hadn't led, and he knew it. He just hoped nobody else noticed. The men in this room were the spiritual descendants of the older men who had identified Billy Bean as a boy of 16 as a future baseball superstar. Invisible to the ordinary fan, they were nevertheless the heart of the game. They decide who gets to play, and therefore how it is played. For the first time in his career, Billy was about to start an argument about how they did what they did. Calling them in from the field and stuffing them into a dank room in the bowels of the Coliseum for the 7 days before the draft had become something of an Oakland custom. It was the point of the exercise that was about to change. A year ago, before the 2001 draft, the goal had been for the general manager of the Oakland A's and his scouts to come to some mutually satisfying decision about who to select with the top picks. Billy had allowed the scouts to lead the discussion and influence his decisions. He had even let the scouts choose a lot of their own guys. That changed about 5 seconds after the 2001 draft, which had been an expensive disaster. The elite players that Billy and the scouts had discussed in advance had been snapped up by other teams before the A's' turn came to make their second and final first-round draft pick. All that remained were guys the scouts loved and Billy knew next to nothing about. In the confusion, Grady Fuson, the A's soon-to-be former head of scouting, had taken a high school pitcher named Jeremy Bonderman. The kid has a 94-mile-per-hour fastball, a clean delivery, and a body that looked as if it had been created to wear a baseball uniform. He was, in short, precisely the kind of pitcher Billy thought he had trained his scouting department to avoid. It was impossible to say whether Jeremy Bonderman would make it to the big leagues, but that wasn't the point. The odds were against him, just as they were against any high school player. The scouts adored high school players, and they especially adored high school pitchers. High school pitchers were so far away from being who they would be when they grew up that you can imagine them becoming almost anything. High school pitchers also had brand new arms, and brand new arms were able to generate the one asset scouts could measure, a fastball's velocity. The most important quality in a pitcher was not his brute strength, but his ability to deceive, and deception took many forms. In any case, you had only to study the history of the draft to see that high school pitchers were twice less likely than college pitchers, and 4 times less likely than college position players to make it to the big leagues. Taking a high school pitcher in the first round and spending $1.2 million to sign him was exactly the sort of thing that happened when you let scouts have their way. It defied the odds. It defied reason. Reason, even science, was what Billy Beane was intent on bringing to baseball. He used many unreasonable means, anger, passion, even physical intimidation, to do it. "My deep-down belief about how to build a baseball team is at odds with my day-to-day personality," he said. "It's a constant struggle for me." It was hard to know what Grady Fuson imagined would happen after he took a high school pitcher with the first pick. On draft day, the Oakland draft room was a ceremonial place. Wives, owners, friends of the owners, all these people who made you think twice before saying fuck, gathered politely along the back wall of the room to watch the Oakland team determine its future. Grady, a soft 5'8 next to Billy's still dangerous-looking 6'4, might have thought that their presence would buffer Billy's fury. It didn't. Professional baseball had violently detached Billy Beane from his youthful self, but Billy was still the guy whose anger after striking out caused the rest of the team to gather on the other end of the bench. When Grady leaned into the phone to take Bonderman, Billy, in a single motion, exploded from his chair, grabbed it, and hurled it right through the wall. When the chair hit the wall, it didn't bang and clang. It exploded. Until they saw the hole Billy had made in it, the scouts had assumed that the wall was, like their futures, solid. Up till then, Grady had every reason to feel secure in his job. Other teams, when they sought to explain to themselves why the Oakland A's had won so many games with so little money and excuse themselves for winning so few with so much, usually invoked the A's scouting. Certainly Grady could never have imagined that his scouting department was on the brink of total overhaul and that his job was on the line. But that was the direction Billy's mind was heading. He couldn't help but notice that his scouting department was the one part of his organization that most resembled the rest of baseball. From that, it followed that it was most in need of change. "The draft has never been anything but a fucking crapshoot," Billy had taken to saying. "We take 50 guys and we celebrate if 2 of them make it." In what other business is 2 for 50 a success? If you did that in the stock market, you'd go broke. Grady had no way of knowing how much Billy disapproved of Grady's most deeply ingrained attitudes. That Billy had come to believe that baseball scouting was at roughly the same stage of development in the 21st century as professional medicine had been in the 18th. Or that all of Billy's beliefs at the moment of Jeremy Bonderman's selection acquired a new intensity. On the other hand, Grady wasn't entirely oblivious to Billy's hostility. He had known enough to be uncomfortable the week before the draft when Billy's assistant, Paul DePodesta, had turned up in the draft room with his laptop. Paul hadn't played pro ball. Paul was a Harvard graduate. Paul looked and sounded more like a Harvard graduate than a baseball man. Maybe more to the point, Paul shouldn't have even been in the draft room. The draft room was for scouts, not assistant general managers. It was Paul's computer that Grady dwelled upon. "What do you need that for?" Grady asked Paul after the meeting, as if he sensed the machine somehow challenged his authority. "You're sitting over there with your computer, and I don't know what you're doing." "I'm just looking at stats," said Paul. "It's easier than printing them all out." Paul wanted to look at stats because the stats offered him new ways of understanding amateur players. He had graduated from college with distinction in economics, but his interest, discouraged by the Harvard Economics Department, had been on the uneasy border of psychology and economics. He was fascinated by irrationality and the opportunities it created in human affairs for anyone who resisted it. He was just the sort of person who might have made an easy fortune in finance, but the market for baseball players, in Paul's view, was far more interesting than anything Wall Street offered. There was, for starters, the tendency of everyone who actually played the game to generalize wildly from his own experience. People always thought their own experience was typical when it wasn't. There was also a tendency to be overly influenced by a guy's most recent performance. What he did last was not necessarily what he would do next. Thirdly, but not lastly, there was the bias towards what people saw with their own eyes or thought they had seen. The human mind played tricks on itself when it relied exclusively on what it saw, and every trick it played was a financial opportunity for someone who saw through the illusion to the reality. There was a lot you couldn't see when you watched a baseball game. For Billy Bean, it was a little different, a little less cerebral and a little more visceral. Billy intended to rip away from the scouts the power to decide who would be a pro baseball player and who would not, and Paul was his weapon for doing it. Grady did not know about that. Grady had ignored Paul's prodding to scout the players his computer flushed out. Paul had said the scouts ought to go have a look at a college kid named Kevin Youkilis. Youkilis was a fat third baseman who couldn't run, throw, or field. What was the point of going to see that? Because, Paul would be able to say 3 months later, Kevin Youkilis has the second highest on-base percentage in all of professional baseball after Barry Bonds. To Paul, he'd become Euclid, the Greek god of walks. Grady and his scouts had ignored Paul when they said they ought to check out a college pitcher named Kirk Sarlous. Sarlous was a short right-hander with an 88-mile-per-hour fastball. Why waste time on a short right-hander? Because, Paul would be able to say less than a year later, Sarlous is one of only two players from the 2001 draft pitching in the big leagues. Raw violence had gotten Grady's attention. It was only baseball tradition that allowed scouting directors and scouts to go off and find the ball players on their own without worrying too much about the GM looking over their shoulders. And if there was one thing Grady knew about Billy, it was that he could give a fuck about baseball tradition. All Billy cared about was winning. A few days after the 2001 draft, with Billy away and still not speaking to him, Grady crept into Paul's office. In conciliatory tones, he allowed, as how he still needed to sign a pitcher, to fill out the A's rookie league roster in Arizona. There was this kid Paul had mentioned, who, along with Youkilis and Sarlous, Grady had ignored. David Beck was his name. Beck had gone completely undrafted. 30 big league teams, each with 50 draft picks, had passed on him. Oddly enough, Paul's computer had spit out Beck's name only because one of Beck's teammates at Cumberland University in Tennessee, a big kid with a 98-mile-an-hour fastball, had made everyone's list as a potential first-round draft pick. Paul had noticed that on the same pitching staff as this consensus first-round pick was this complete unknown, a 6'4 left-hander who had even better numbers than the first-rounder. A lower earned run average, fewer home runs allowed, more strikeouts, and fewer walks per 9 innings. And Paul just wondered, maybe the kid had something going for him that the scouts were missing. He was left wondering. Months passed without any word of Beck from the scouting department. Paul finally asked Grady about him. And Grady had said, "Oh yeah, I forgot, I'll have one of the scouts go have a look." But he didn't do it, at least not seriously. When Paul asked again, Billy Owens, the A's scout responsible for covering Tennessee, grudgingly came back to him with the word that Beck was a soft tosser. Soft tosser was scouting code for not worth my time. Paul still had the impression that no one had bothered to scout David Beck. When he came to see Paul after the draft, Grady was in a different mood about David Beck. "Should we sign your guy?" he asked. "What guy?" asked Paul. He'd forgotten about Beck. "Beck," said Grady. "Grady, he's not my guy," said Paul. "I just asked you to check him out." Grady was eager to make peace with the front office, and he thought he could do it by throwing Paul a bone. He ran off and signed David Beck, sight unseen. A few days later, Beck reported for duty at the A's training facility in Scottsdale, Arizona. Most of the scouts and Paul happened to be there when Beck warmed up in the A's bullpen. It was one of the most bizarre sights any of them ever had seen on a pitcher's mound. When the kid drew back his left arm to throw, his left hand flopped and twirled maniacally. His wrist might as well not exist. At any moment, it seemed, his hand might disengage itself and fly away. The kid was double-jointed, maybe even crippled. At that moment, David Beck ceased to be known to the scouts as David Beck and became simply the creature. A scout from another organization came right up to Billy O, chuckling, and asked how he came to sign the creature. Billy O pointed over to Paul and said, "I didn't sign him. Paul made me do it." Whereupon the creature went out and dominated the Arizona Rookie League. He and his Halloween hand and his 84-mile-per-hour fastball shut down the opposition so completely that the opposition never knew what happened. In the short season, the creature pitched 18 innings in relief, struck out 32 batters, and finished with an earned run average of an even 1.0. He was named the closer on the Rookie League All-Star team. The creature was the first thing to come out of Paul's computer that the A's scouting department signed. There were about to be a lot more. The 2002 draft was to be the first science experiment Billy Beane performed upon amateur players. It wasn't quite 10 in the morning, and everyone in the draft room except the Harvard graduates had a lip full of chewing tobacco. The snuff rearranged their features into masks of grim determination. Anyone whose name wasn't two syllables or didn't end in a vowel or a spittable consonant has had it changed for the benefit of baseball conversation. Ron Hopkins is Hoppy. Chris Pitaro is Pitter. Dick Bogard is Bogey. Most were former infielders who had topped out someplace in the minor leagues. A handful actually made it to the big leagues, but so briefly that it almost hadn't happened at all. John Poloni had pitched 7 innings in 1977 with the Texas Rangers. Kelly Heath had played second base in the Royals organization and had exactly 1 major league at-bat in 1982 after the Royals' regular second baseman, Frank White, decided in the middle of a game that his hemorrhoids were bothering him. As one of the other scouts put it, Kelly was the only player in history whose entire big league career was made possible by a single asshole. Chris Pitaro had played second base for the Tigers and Twins. Back in 1985, during Pitter's rookie year, Detroit's manager Sparky Anderson was quoted saying Pitter has a chance to become the greatest second baseman who ever lived. It hadn't turned out that way. All of them had lived different versions of the same story. They were uncoiled springs, firecrackers that had failed to explode. The only bona fide big league regular in the room was Matt Keogh, who won 16 games for the A's in 1980. In his rookie year in 1978, he'd pitched in the All-Star game. Matty, as he is known, easily was the most detached of the group. He had the air of a man taking a break from some perpetual Hawaiian vacation of the soul to stop by and chat with his old buddies. The rest of them weren't like that. There was no avoiding just how important the 2002 amateur draft was for the future of the Oakland A's. The Oakland A's survived by finding cheap labor. The treatment of amateur players is the most glaring of the many violations of free market principles in Major League Baseball. A team that drafts and signs a player holds the rights to his first 7 years in the minor leagues and his first 6 in the majors. It also enjoys the right to pay the player far less than he is worth. For instance, the Oakland A's were able to pay their all-star pitcher Barry Zito $200,000 in 2000, $240,000 in 2001, and $500,000 in 2002, when he would win the Cy Young Award as the best pitcher in the American League, because they had drafted him in 1999. For his first 3 years of big league ball, Zito was stuck. For his next 3 years, he could apply for salary arbitration, which would bump him up to maybe a few million dollars a year, but would still keep him millions below the 10 to 15 million a year he could get for himself on the open market. Not until 2007, after he had been in the big leagues for 6 years, would Barry Zito, like any other citizen of the Republic, be allowed to auction his services to the highest bidder. At which point, of course, the Oakland A's would no longer be able to afford Barry Zito. That's why it was important to find Barry Zito here in the draft room and obtain him for the period of his career when he could be paid the baseball equivalent of slave's wages. This year was the best chance they might ever have to find several Barry Zitos. In 2001, the A's had lost all three of their top free agents to richer teams. First baseman Jason Giambi had left with the Yankees for $120 million over 7 years. Outfielder Johnny Damon had gone to the Red Sox for $32 million over 4 years. Closer Jason Isringhausen had signed with the Cardinals for $28 million over 4 years. The $33 million the three players would make each year was just $5 million less than the entire Oakland team. The rules of the game granted the A's the first round draft picks of the three teams that had poached their top talent, plus three more compensation picks at the end of the first round. Together with their own first-round pick, the A's had, in effect, 7 first-round draft picks. In the history of the draft going back to 1965, no team had ever held 7 first-round picks. The question for Billy Beane was what to do with them. What he wasn't going to do with them was what Grady had done last year, or what old baseball men had done with them for the past 37 years. "You know what?" Billy said to Paul before the draft room meetings. "However we do it, we're never going to be more wrong than the way we did it before." Already the scouts had whittled, or thought they had whittled, the vast universe of North American amateur baseball down to 680 players. They'd pasted all the names onto little magnetic strips. They now had 1 week to reduce that pile of magnetic nameplates to some kind of order. They would do this, more or less, by a process of elimination. Eric would read a kid's name off a sheet. The scout who knew the kid then offered up a brief, dispassionate description of him. Anyone else who had seen the kid play might then chime in. Then the floor was open for general discussion until everyone was satisfied that enough had been said. They begin that first morning by weeding out the pile. Some large number of amateur ballplayers were, for one reason or another, unworthy of serious consideration. "Lark," says Eric, for instance. Eric is Eric Kubota, the new young scouting director Billy hired to replace Grady. Eric used a giant wad of Copenhagen to disguise the fact that he was a brainy graduate of the University of California, Berkeley, whose first job with the Oakland A's had been as a public relations intern. That Eric had never played even high school ball was, in Billy Beane's mind, a point in his favor. At least he hasn't learned the wrong lessons. Billy had played pro ball and regarded it as an experience he needed to overcome if he wanted to do his job well. A reformed alcoholic is how he described himself. Lark is a high school pitcher with a blazing fastball. He's a favorite of one of the older scouts, who introduces him in a language only faintly resembling English. "Good body, big arm, good fastball, playable slider, so-so change," he says. "A little funk on the backside, but nothing you can't clean up. I saw him good one day and not so good another." "Any risk he'll go to college?" asks Eric. "He's not a student type," says the older scout. "I'm not sure he's even signed with a college." "So is this guy a rockhead?" asks Pitter. Pitter, Chris Pitaro, is a graduate of the University of North Carolina who roomed with Billy when they both played for the Minnesota Twins, and who Billy had long ago identified as a person willing to rethink everything he learned, or thought he had learned, playing baseball. Says the older scout, thinking about how to address the question. It's possible for a baseball player to be too stupid for the job. It's also possible for him to be too smart. He may be too smart is a phrase that will recur several times over the next week. He's a confident kid. But, says Eric, there might be some, family issues here, says the old scout. I heard that Dad had spent some time in prison. Porno or something. No one on either side of the room seems to know what to make of that. You can see 30 men thinking, is porno a crime? Can he bring it? Someone finally asks. The air clears. I can see this guy in somebody's pen throw an aspirin tablet someday, says the older scout. The guy has a cannon. This old scout is pushing 55 but still has a lean quickness about him, as if he hadn't completely abandoned the hope that he might one day play the game. The old scout likes high school kids and refuses to apologize for that fact. I'm worried about the makeup, says someone. What does his profile say? Asks someone else. A young man sits quietly off to one side of the room's lone desktop computer. He punches a few keys. He's looking for Lark's results on the psychological test given by Major League Baseball to all prospects. Not good, he says at length. Competitive drive, 1 out of 10. Leadership, 1 out of 10. Conscientiousness, 1 out of 10. He keeps on reading down the list, but no matter what the category, the kid's score is always the same. Shit, Bogey finally says. Does he even have a 2 in anything? Bogey is the oldest scout. In 1972, scouting for the Houston Astros, Bogey administered what he believes to have been the first ever baseball psychological test to a pitcher named Dick Ruthven. He passed. Bad makeup, says someone else, and no one disagrees. The scouts used several catchphrases to describe what they need to avoid. Rockhead clearly isn't a good thing to be, but the quality can be overcome. Soft is also fairly damning. It connotes both out of shape and wimp, but it too is inconclusive. Bad makeup is a death sentence. Bad makeup means this kid's got problems we can't afford to solve. The phrase signaled anything from jail time to drinking problems to severe personality disorders. Whenever a player is convicted of bad makeup, another young man reaches into a cardboard box for a tiny magnetized photograph of a former A's employee named Phil Melo. Melo had worked as one of Billy Beane's assistants for a brief spell and in that time offended pretty much everyone in the organization. When I ask Paul how it was possible for one man to personify so many different personality disorders, Paul says, put it this way. On the day I was hired, Melo came over to meet me. The first thing out of his mouth was, I gotta be honest with you, I'm really not pleased we hired you. Melo was just that kind of guy. During the first few days of the draft meetings, the tiny photos of Phil Melo fly like confetti, and the conversations that ended with Melo's picture plastered beside a prospect's name told you something. Not just what baseball men distrusted in a player's character, but how little they really knew the people they were about to rain money on. A high school pitcher. Where's he going to college? Asks Billy idly. He's not, says the scout, who knows him best. He's a Christian kid, and he was given a free ride to UC Irvine. Coach set him up with a couple of his players. Took him to a party, and all it was drinking. Kid was offended, and he left and said, I'm not going to school. Oh, then he'll fit right into pro ball, won't he, says Billy. Put a Melo on him, says Eric. A collegiate right-handed pitcher. He's a cocky guy, says Matt Keogh, who is arguing on the pitcher's behalf. He'd shove it up your ass and taunt you, so you hate the guy. He's had a couple of ejections. But no drugs? Asks Eric. No drugs, says Matty, then thinks about it. There are rumors of some hash. An old scout laughs. Corned beef hash. It's unsubstantiated, Maddie protests. Where there's smoke, there's fire, says an old scout.